I muttered, feeling more power stir. The chlorophene bellowed again, sending a jolt of fear through me, and the winds rose even more.
Vento! Vento vintas servitas!
Power, magic, coursed through my outstretched arms and lashed out at the night. The wind rose in a sudden roar, a screaming cyclone that whirled into being just in front of me and then whirled out toward the heavy metal shelving. The chlorophene screamed again, nearly drowned out by the windstorm I'd called, only a few yards away. The enormous, heavy shelves, loaded with tons of materials, let out a groan of protest and then fell, toppled over onto the chlorophene with a deafening din that rippled at my ears and shook the concrete floor. The chlorophene was strong, but it wasn't that strong. It went down like a bush under a bulldozer, shrieked again as the steel shelves crushed it and burned into its substance. A foul, grayish smoke rose from the wreckage, and the chlorophene continued to scream and thrash, the shelves jerking and moving. Exhaustion swept over me with the effort of the spell, and I glowered down at the fallen shelves. Down, I panted. But not out. Damn it. I watched the shelves for a moment and decided that the chlorophene probably wouldn't shrug it off for a few minutes. I shook my head and headed for the gate to the enclosure. Hopefully Grum hadn't twisted things up so badly that I couldn't get out. He had. The metal latch on the gate had been pinched into a mess by his talons. He had scored the metal in sharp notches like an industrial cutter. Note to self, don't think steel can stop Grum's fingernails. I checked above and decided to risk climbing the fence and getting through the barbed wire. I'd gotten maybe halfway up the chain-length fence when Murphy limped out of the mist on the other side, her gun pointed right at me. "Whoa, whoa, Murph," I said. I showed her my hands and promptly fell off the fence. "It's me." She lowered the gun and let out her breath. "Christ, Harry, what are you doing?" "Texas cage match," I won. From behind me, the chlorophene let out another shriek, and the shelving groaned as it shifted. I gulped and looked back. "Rematch doesn't look promising, though. Where have you been?" She rolled her eyes. "Shopping." "Where's Grum and the ghoul?" "Don't know. The ghoul's blood trail went out and someone shot at me when I followed it. Haven't seen the ogre." She blinked at the gate's latch. "Damn. Guess he shut you in here, huh?" "Pretty much. You get shot?" "No. Why?" "You're limping." Murphy grimaced. "Yeah, one of those bastards must have thrown a bunch of marbles on the floor. I slipped on one. It's my knee." "Oh," I said. Murphy blinked at me. "You did that?" "Well, it was a plan at the time." "Harry, that's not a plan. It's a Looney Tune. Kill me later. Help me out of here now." I squinted up at the barbed wire. "Maybe if you get a rake, you can push it up for me so I can slide between it and the fence." "We're 20 feet from the hardware department, genius," Murphy said. She limped back into the mist and returned half a minute later, carrying a pair of bolt cutters. She cut the slit in the chain-link fence, and I squeezed through it while the chlorophene thrashed, still pinned. "I could kiss you," I said. Murphy grinned. "You smell like manure, Harry." The smile faded. "What now?" The trapped monster's thrashing sent several smaller shelves toppling over, and I rubbernecked nervously. "Getting out is still the first priority. That thing is down, but it'll be coming before long." "What is it?" "Chlorophene," I said. "A what?" "Plant monster." "Oh, right. We need to get out." Murphy shook her head. "Whoever was covering the exit out front can probably see the other doors, too. A silhouette in a doorway is a great target. It's just like a shooting range." "How the blazes did you see through the mist? Is that really important right now?" "They can, and it means we can't go out the front." "Yeah," I said. "You're right. The main exits are covered. That thing is in the garden center, and 10-1 Ogre Grum is watching the back." "Ogre, check. What's his deal?" "Bullets bounce off him. He shakes off magic like a duck does water. He's strong and pretty quick and smarter than he looks." Murphy let out a soft curse. "You can't blast him like you did the Loop Guru." I shook my head. "I gave him a hard shot once already. I may as well have been spitting on him." "Doesn't look like we have much choice for getting out. And even if we do, Grum, or that plant thing, could run us down, so we'll need wheels." "We'll have to go through one of them." "I know," I said, and I headed back to the store. Where are you going? Murphy demanded. I have a plan. She limped after me. Better than a Looney Tune one, I hope. I grunted in reply. No need to agree with her. We both realized that if this plan wasn't better than the last one, then, as Porky Pig would say, that's all, folks. Chapter 21. 3 minutes later, Murphy and I went out the back door, and Grum was waiting for us. He rose up out of the shadows by the large trash bins with a bull elephant's bellow and stomped toward us. Murphy, dragging a leg and wrapped somewhat desperately in a plaid auto blanket, let out a shrill cry and turned to run, but tripped and fell on the ground before the ogre. I kept my left hand behind my back and lifted my right. Flame danced up from my cupped fingers, and I thundered, "Grum!" The ogre's beady eyes turned to me, glittering. He let out another rumbling snarl. "Stand thee from my path," I called in that same overdramatic voice, "lest I grow weary of thee and bereft thee of thy life." The ogre focused wholly on me now, striding forward past the whimpering form of Murphy. "I do not fear thy power, mortal," he snarled. I lifted my chin and waved my fire-holding hand around a bit. "This is thy last warning, fairy dog." Grum's beady eyes grew angrier. He let out a harsh laugh and did not slow down. "Fable mortal trickster, thy spellfire means nothing to me. Do thy worst." Behind Grum, Murphy threw the auto blankets off of her shoulders and with one rip of the starting cord fired up her shiny new Coleman chainsaw. She engaged the blade with a hissing whir of air and without preamble swung it in an arc that ended precisely at the back of Grum's thick, hairy knee. The steel blade chewed through the ogre's hide as if it were made of styrofoam. Blood and bits of meat flew up in a gruesome cloud. The ogre screamed, his body contorting in agony. The scarlet skin around the injury immediately swelled, darkening to black, and tendrils of infectious-looking darkness spread from the wound up over the ogre's leg and hip within the space of a breath. He swept one huge fist at Murphy, but she was already getting out of his reach. The ogre's weight came down on the injured leg, and Grum fell to earth with a heavy thud. I started forward to help, but everything was happening fast, and my movements felt nightmarishly slow. The ogre rolled to his belly at once, maddened at the touch of iron in the chainsaw's blade, and started dragging himself toward Murphy faster than I would have believed with just his arms, talons gouging into the concrete. She hurried away from him, limping, but Grum slammed one fist down on the concrete so hard that a half a dozen feet away she was jarred off balance and fell. Grum got hold of Murphy's foot and started dragging her back toward him. She let out a hollow gasp, then twisted and wriggled. She slipped out of her sneaker and hauled herself away from the ogre, her face gone white and drawn. I ran up behind Grum, pulling my left hand out from behind my back, the fingers of my right hand still curling around the flickering flame I'd shown the ogre. A large yellow and green pump-pressure water gun sloshed a little in my left fist. I lowered it and squeezed the trigger. A stream of gasoline spread out all over Grum's back, soaking the ogre's skin. Grum whirled toward me halfway through, and I shot the gasoline into his eyes and nose, eliciting another scream. He bared his fangs and glared at me through eyes swollen almost shut. "Wizard," he said, hardly understandable through the fangs and the drool, "your spell flame will not stop me." I turned my right hand slowly and showed Grum the burning can of Sterno I'd been palming. "Good thing I've got this plain old vanilla fire then, huh?" I tossed the lit can of Sterno onto the gasoline-soaked ogre. Hamstrung and blazing like a birthday candle, Grum screamed and thrashed. I skipped back and around him, helping Murphy up to her feet as the ogre slammed himself against the ground and then against the back wall of the Walmart. He did that in a frenzy for maybe 20 seconds before uttering an odd, undulating cry and hurling himself at a deep shadow behind a trash bin and vanished, the light from the flames simply disappearing. Murphy got up only with my help, her face pale with pain. She could put no weight at all on her wounded leg.
"What happened?"
"We whipped them," I said. He packed up and headed back to Ferry. For good? I shook my head. For now. How's the leg? Hurts. I think I broke something. I can hop on the other one. Lean on me, I said. We went a few paces, and she swayed dangerously. I caught her before she toppled. Murph? Sorry, she gasped. Hopping. Bad idea. I helped her back down to the ground. Look, stay here against the wall. I'll get the beetle and pull it around here to you. Murphy was in enough pain to keep her from arguing. She did draw her gun, switch the safety on, and offer it to me. I shook my head. Keep it. You might need it. Dresden, Murphy said. My gun has been about as useful as fabric softener in a steel mill tonight. But someone out there has a rifle. If they're using one, it's because they're a human, and you don't have most of your magic stuff with you. Take the gun. She was right, but I argued anyway. I can't leave you defenseless, Murph. Murph hauled up the leg of her jeans and pulled a tiny automatic from an ankle holster. She worked the slide, checked the safety, and said, I'm covered. I took the Colt, checked the chamber and the safety, more or less by reflex. That's a cute little gun there, Murph. She scowled at me. I have small ankles. It's the only one I can hide there. I chanted, teasing, Murphy's got a girl gun, Murphy's got a girl gun. Murphy glowered at me and hauled the chainsaw to within easy reach. Come a little closer and say that. I snorted at her. Give me a couple more minutes, I said. I'll tell you if it's me. Some of these bad guys can play dress-up, so if you aren't sure who it is. Murphy nodded, pale and resolved, and rested her hand on the gun. I drew a deep breath and walked through the mist, through the side of the building, and toward the front parking lot. I kept close to the wall and moved as quietly as I could, listening as I went. I gathered up energy for the shield bracelet and held my left hand ready. I held the gun in my right. Holding a pair of defenses focused around my left hand, I would have to do all my shooting with my right. I'm not a very good shot, even when I can use both hands, so I just had to hope that no sharpshooting would be required. I got to the front of the building before I heard something click in the fenced area of the garden center. I swallowed and pointed the Colt at it, noting that I wasn't sure how many rounds the gun had left. As I came closer, through the mist, I saw the chain fence around the ruined area where it had been trapped with a chlorofiend. It had been torn down and swathed 10 feet wide, and from what I could see of the inside, the tree thing wasn't there anymore. Great. I took a few steps closer to the break in the fence to stare at the ruined chain link. I expected bent and stretched wire, still hot enough to burn where it had torn. Instead, I found edges cut off as neatly as with a set of clippers and coated with frost. I checked around on the ground and found sections of wire, none of them longer than 2 or 3 inches. Steam curled up from them, and the cold in the air near the fence made me shiver. The fence had been frozen, chilled, until the steel had become brittle and then shattered. Winter, I muttered. I guess that wasn't much of a stretch. I swept my eyes through the mist, left my ears open, and paced as quietly as I could toward the dim, flickering lights that lay somewhere ahead in the parking lot. I'd parked the Beetle in an aisle almost even with the front doors, but I didn't have a reference point through the mist. I just headed out, picked the first row of cars, and started prowling silently along them, looking for the Beetle. My car wasn't in the first row, but a thin stream of some kind of yellowish fluid was. I traced it to the next row and found the Beetle sitting there in its motley colors. Another leak. They weren't exactly unheard of in a wizard's car, but this would be a hell of a time for the Beetle to get hospitalized. I got in and set the gun down long enough to shove my keys in the ignition. My trusty steed wheezed and groaned a few times, but the engine turned over with an apologetic cough and the car rattled to life. I put it in gear, pulling through the empty space in front of me, and headed for the back of the building to get Murphy. I had just passed the garden center with its ruined fence when my windows abruptly frosted over. It happened in the space of a breath, ice crystals forming and growing like plants on a stop-motion film until my view was completely cut off. The temperature dropped by maybe 50 degrees, and the car sputtered. If I hadn't given it a bunch of gas, it would have stalled. The Beetle lurched forward and I rolled down the window, sticking my head out the side in an effort to see what was going on. The chlorofiend loomed up out of the mist and brought one huge, knobby fist down on the beetle like an organic wrecking ball. The force of it crumpled the hood like tin foil and drove the shocks down so that the frame smashed up against the tires. The impact threw me forward against the steering wheel and drove the breath out of me with a shock of pain. The impact would have rolled any car with an engine under the hood. Most of the mass of the car would have been driven down. The lighter rear end would have flipped up, and me, without my seatbelt, would have been bounced around like a piece of popcorn. The old Volkswagens, though, have their engine in the back. Most of the weight of the car got bounced up a little in the air and then came back down to the ground with a jolt. I slammed my foot on the gas harder, and the Beetle's engine sputtered gamely in response. As big and strong as the chlorofiend might be, it wasn't solid, and it wasn't as heavy as a living mass of the same size. The Beetle bounced up from the blow that had crumpled the empty storage compartment under the hood and slammed into the chlorofiend without losing much of its momentum. The beast let out a shriek of what might have been surprise and was definitely pain. My car hammered into it with a flickering of scarlet static and a cloud of smoke from the substance of the fairy creature, swept under its legs, and drove, the chlorofiend atop its hood. I kept my foot on the gas, held the wheel as steadily as I could with one hand, and stuck my head out the window so I could see. The chlorofiend screamed again, the magic around it gathering in a cloud that made the hairs on my neck stand up. But the Beetle rattled through the attempt to hex it down, carrying the chlorofiend the length of the Walmart Garden Center and to the back of the building. "Think of it as payback for all those telephone poles," I muttered to the Beetle and slammed on the brakes. The chlorofiend rolled off of my car, skidded on the asphalt, and slammed into the side of a metal trash bin with a yowl of pain and an exploding cloud of dirt clods. Only one of my headlights appeared to have survived the attack, and even it flickered woozily through the mist and the cloud of dust and dirt rising from the chlorofiend. I slammed the car into reverse, backed up a few more feet, then put it back into neutral. I raced the engine, then popped the clutch and sent the Beetle hurtling at the monster. I braced myself for impact this time and pulled my head in before I hit. The impact felt violent, shockingly loud, and viscerally satisfying. The chlorofiend let out a broken-sounding creak, but until I backed the car up and whipped the wheel around so I could see out the side of the window, I couldn't tell what had happened. I'd torn the thing in half, at about the middle, pinching it between the battered, frost-coated Beetle and the metal trash bin. Thank the stars it hadn't been a fiberglass job. The legs lay against the trash bin, now only a pile of twisted saplings and earth, while the arms flailed toward me, a dozen long paces away, uselessly pounding the asphalt. I spat out my window, put the car into gear again, and went to get Murphy. I jumped out of the car and had to wrench the passenger door hard to get it to open. Murphy pushed herself up, using the wall for support, and stared at the frost-covered Beetle with wide eyes. What the hell happened? The plant monster. A plant monster and Frosty the Snowman? I got on her wounded side to support her. I took care of it. Let's go. Murphy let out another small sound of pain, but she didn't let it stop her from hobbling along toward the car. I was just about to help her when she shouted, "Harry!" and threw her weight against me. The chlorofiend, the upper half, had somehow clawed its way out of the mist, and one long, viney limb was reaching for me. I fell back away from it and tried to shield Murphy with my body. It got me. I felt fingers the size of young tree trunks wrap around my throat and jerk me away from Murphy like it was a puppy. More branch fingers got one of my thighs, and I felt myself suspended in the air and pulled slowly apart.
"Meddler," hissed an alien voice from somewhere near the chlorofiend's glowing green eyes. "You should never have involved yourself in these affairs. You have no concept of what is at stake. Die for your arrogance."
I tried for a witty riposte, but my vision blackened out and my head felt like it was trapped in a slowly tightening vice. I tried gathering forces, attempting to push them through my shield bracelet, but the moment I did there was a rustle of wood and leaves, and the bracelet snapped off my wrist, broken. I tried to gather another spell, and realized as I did that my concentration had wavered too much, and that my defense against the insidious enchantment of the mist had begun to fail.
My thoughts broke apart into irregular pieces, and I struggled to reach for them and put them together again as the pressure on my body increased, became a red-hot agony. I only dimly heard the chainsaw start up again, and Murphy's scream of challenge. The charm she wore wasn't relying on my concentration. It wouldn't last long, but it would keep the mist away from her for a few more minutes. The chlorophene let out a shriek, and I heard the saw biting into wood, felt wood chips hitting my face. I tumbled free, sapling branches tangling all around my head and shoulders, leaves and dirt scratching my face. My leg was still in the chlorophene's grip, but I could breathe again. The mist pressed close to me, giving me a sense of detachment and disinterest. It was hard to make any sense of what happened next. Murphy hopped closer, her weight on one leg, and swept the chainsaw through the chlorophene's other arm. I fell to the ground, more inert tree parts around me. The chlorophene waved its arms at Murphy, but they didn't have the crippling force I'd seen it use before. They merely jostled her and knocked her down. Murphy snarled, crawling on her hands and knees, dragging the chainsaw with her. She lifted it again and drove it at the creature's head. Engine racing, blade singing through the air. The chlorophene screamed in protest and frustration, lifting the stumps, get it, stumps, of its arms in feeble defense. Murphy tore through them with a chainsaw, snicker-snack, and then drove the blade directly between the chlorophene's glowing green eyes. The monster shrieked again, writhing, but its arms never managed to do more than shove Murphy around a bit. Then it let out a final groan, and the eyes winked out. Murphy suddenly sat atop a mound of dirt and leaves and gnarled branches. I lay there, staring stupidly at her, then heard a gunshot, the sharp, cracking report of a rifle. Murphy threw herself down and rolled toward me. A second shot rang out, and a puff of leaves a foot to Murphy's right leapt into the air. Another sound cut through the night, police sirens getting closer. Murphy dragged me and herself over the ground toward the car. I heard a harsh curse somewhere in the mist, and then a pair of footsteps retreating. A moment later, I thought the mist was starting to thin out. "Harry," Murphy said, shaking me. I blinked at her, and the relief showed in her worried expression. "Harry, can you hear me?" I nodded. My mouth felt dry, and my body ached. I fought to clear my head. "Get us in the car," she said, enunciating the words. "Get us in the car and get us out of here." The car. Right. I hauled Murphy into the Beetle, got in myself, and stared at the frosted windshield. The heat of the summer night was already melting the frost away, and I could see through it in spots. "Harry," Murphy said, exasperated, her voice thin and shaky. "Drive!" "Oh, right. Drive. Get out." I put the Beetle in gear, more or less, and we lurched out of the parking lot and out of the mist.
Chapter 22. "You're kidding," Billy said, his voice touched with disbelief. "A chainsaw? Where'd you get the gasoline?"
Murphy looked up from her wounded leg and the willowy Georgia, who had cut her jeans away and was cleaning out the long gashes she'd acquired from ankle to mid-calf. "Gas generator, backup power supply for all the food freezers. They had a 10-gallon plastic jug of it." Billy's apartment was not a large one, and with a dozen people in it, even with the air conditioning running at full blast, it was too hot and too crowded. The Alphas, Billy's werewolf accomplices, were out in force. We'd been challenged by a tall, thin young man in the parking lot and shadowed to the door by a pair of wolves who kept just far enough away to make it difficult to see them in the shadows. When I'd first seen them, the Alphas had been a collection of misfits with bad hair, acne, and wannabe tough guy leather outfits. In the year and a half since, they'd changed. None of them had that pale look anymore. None of them looked wheezy. And like Billy, the kids who'd been carrying baby fat had swapped it for lean, fit muscle. They hadn't become a gang of Hollywood soap opera stars or anything, but they looked more relaxed, more confident, more happy. And I saw some scars, some of them quite vicious, showing on bare limbs. Most of the kids wore sweats or those pullover knit dresses, garments that could be gotten out of in a hurry. Pizza boxes were stacked 3 deep on the table, and a cooler of soft drinks sat on the floor nearby.
I piled a plate with half-warm pizza, picked up a Coke, and found a comparatively empty stretch of wall to lean against. Billy shook his head and said, "Look, Harry, some of this doesn't make sense. I mean, if they could really run around doing this mind fog thing, shouldn't we have heard about it by now?" I snorted and set around a mouthful of pizza. "It's pretty rare, even in my circles. No one who got hit with it will remember it. Check the paper tomorrow. 10 to 1, emergency services showed up after we left, put out the fires, pulled a bunch of confused people out of the building, and the official explanation is a leaky gas line." Billy snorted. "That doesn't make any sense. There's not going to be evidence of an exploding gas line. No leak is going to show up at the gas company. No continuing fire of leaking gas." I kept eating. "Get real, Billy," I said. "You think people are going to be taken seriously by City Hall if they tell them, 'We really don't know what messed up all these people. We don't know what caused all the damage. We don't know why no one heard or saw anything. And we don't know what the reports of gunshots at the scene were all about.'" "Hell no. People would be accused of incompetence, publicly embarrassed, fired. No one wants that. So, gas leak." "But it's stupid. It's life. The last thing the 21st century wants to admit is that it might not know everything." I popped open the Coke and guzzled some. "How's the leg, Murph?" "It hurts," Murphy reported, considerately leaving out the implied, "You idiot." Georgia stood up from attending Murphy's leg and shook her head. She was nearly a foot taller than Billy and had bound her blonde hair back into a tight braid. It emphasized the gauntness of her features. "The cuts and bruises are nothing major, but your knee could be seriously damaged. You should have it checked out by a real doctor, Lieutenant Murphy." "Karen," Murphy said. "Anybody who mops up my blood can call me Karen." I tossed Murphy a Coke. She caught it and said, "Except you, Dresden. Any diet?" I put several slices of pizza on a paper plate and passed them over. "Live a little." "All right, Karen," Georgia said, folding her arms. "If you don't want a $25,000 surgery, along with 7 or 8 months of rehab, we need to get you to the hospital." Murphy frowned and then nodded and said, "Let me eat something first. I'm starving." "I'll get in the car," Georgia said. She turned to Billy. "Make sure she doesn't put any weight on that leg when you bring her down. Keep it straight if you can." "Got it," Billy said. "Phil, Greg, get that blanket. We'll make a litter out of it." "I'm not an infant," Murphy said. I put my hand on her shoulder. "Easy," I said in a quiet voice. "They can handle themselves." "So can I." "You're hurt, Murph," I said. "If you were one of your people, you'd be telling them to shut up and stop being part of the problem." Murphy shot me a glower, but its edge was blunted by the big mouthful of pizza she took. "Yeah, I know. I just hate being sidelined," I grunted. "What are you going to do?" she asked. I shook my head. "Finish this Coke. I hadn't planned much past that," she sighed. "All right, Harry, look. I'll be home in a few hours. I'll keep digging. See if I can turn up anything about Lloyd's slate. If you need information on anything else, get in touch." "You should rest," I told her. She grimaced at her leg. Her knee was swollen to a couple of times its normal size. "Looks like I'm going to have plenty of time for that." I grunted again and looked away. "Hey, Harry," Murphy said. When I didn't look at her, she continued. "What happened to me wasn't your fault. I knew the risks, and I took them." "You shouldn't have had to." "No one should. We live in an imperfect world, Dresden, in case that hasn't yet become obvious enough for you." She nudged my leg with her elbow. "Besides, you were lucky I was there. The way I count it, I'm the one who put on the boots." A smile threatened my expression. "You did what?" "Put on the boots," Murphy said. "I put on the boots, kicked some monster ass. I dropped the ghoul. I'm the one who rammed the chainsaw through the head of that plant monster thing. Crippled the ogre, too." "What did you do?" "You threw a can of Sterno at him. That's barely an assist." "Yeah, but I soaked him in gasoline first." She snorted at me around some more pizza. "Shut out." "Whatever." "Murphy 3, Dresden 0. You didn't do all of it. I put on the boots." I raised my hands. "Okay, okay, you've got boots, Murph." She sniffed and took an almost dainty sip of Coke. "Lucky I was there." I squeezed her shoulder and said with no particular inflection, "Yes, thank you." Murphy smiled up at me. From the window, one of the alphas reported, "Car's ready." Billy and a couple more laid out a blanket and then carefully lifted Murphy onto it. She tolerated them with a roll of her eyes, but hissed with discomfort even at the gentle motion. "Call," she said. Will. Wash your back, Harry. Then they carried her out. I picked up some more pizza, exchanged some more or less polite chit-chat with some of the alphas, and made my escape from the crowded living room of the apartment to the balcony. I shut the sliding glass door behind me. Only one light in the parking lot provided any illumination, so the balcony was mostly covered in sheltering shadows. The night was a close one, humidity cooking along at a lazy summer broil, but even so it felt less claustrophobic than the crowded apartment. I watched Billy and the Alphas load Murphy into the minivan and drive off. Then there was as much silence as you ever get in Chicago. The hiss of tires on asphalt was a constant liquid background, punctuated with occasional sirens, horns, mechanical squeaks and squeals, and the buzzing of one locust that must have been perched on a building nearby. I put my paper plate on the wooden balcony railing, closed my eyes, and took a deep breath, trying to clear my head.
"Penny for your thoughts," said a quiet female voice.
I nearly jumped off the balcony in sheer reaction. My hand brushed the paper plate and the pizza fell into the parking lot below. I whirled around and found Merrill sitting in a chair at the other side of the balcony, deep in shadows, her large form nothing more than a more solid piece of darkness. But her eyes gleamed in the half-light, reflecting traces of red. She'd watched the plate fall and then said, "Sorry." "It's okay," I said. "Just a little nervous tonight." She nodded. "I was listening." I nodded back to her and returned to looking at nothing, listening to night sounds. After a while, she asked me, "Does it hurt?" I waved my bandaged hand idly. "Sort of." "Not that," she said. "I meant watching your friend get hurt." Some of my racing thoughts coalesced into irritated anger. "What kind of question is that?" "A simple one." I took an angry hit from my can of Coke. "Of course it hurts. You're different than I thought you'd be." I squinted over my shoulder at her. "They tell stories about you, Mr. Dresden." "It's all a lie." Her teeth gleamed. "Not all of them are bad."
"Mostly good or mostly bad?"
"It depends on who's talking. The she crowd thinks you're an interesting mortal pet of Mab's. The vampire wannabe crowd thinks you're some sort of psychotic vigilante with a penchant for vengeance and mayhem. Sort of a one-man Spanish Inquisition. Most of the magical crowd thinks you're distant, dangerous, but smart and honorable. Crooks thinks you're a hitman for the outfit, or maybe one of the families back east. Straights thinks you're a fraud, trying to bilk people out of their hard-won cash. Except for Larry Fowler, who probably wants you on the show again."
I regarded her, frowning. "And what do you think?"
"I think you need a haircut." She lifted a can to her mouth and caught a whiff of beer. "Bill called all the morgues and hospitals. No Jane Doe with green hair."
"Didn't figure there would be. I talked to Aurora. She seemed concerned."
"She would. She's everyone's big sister. Thinks she needs to take care of the whole world."
"She didn't know anything."
Merrill shook her head and was quiet for a while before she asked, "What is it like, being a wizard?"
I shrugged. "Mostly it's like being a watch fob repairman. It's both difficult and not in demand."
The rest of the time, more emotion rose in me, threatening my self-control. Merrill waited.
"The rest of the time," I picked up, "it's scary as hell. You start learning the kinds of things that go bump in the night, and you figure out ignorance is bliss is more than just a quotable quote. And it's..." I clenched my hands. "It's so damn frustrating. You see people get hurt. Innocents. Friends. I try to make a difference. But I usually don't know what the hell's going on until someone's already dead. It doesn't matter what kind of job I do. I can't help these folks."
"Sounds hard," Merrill said.
I shrugged. "I guess it isn't any different than what anyone else goes through. The names just get changed." I finished off the Coke and stomped the dead soldier flat. "What about you? What's it like being a changeling?"
Merrill rolled the beer can between her broad hands.
"About like anyone, until you hit puberty. Then you start feeling things."
"What kinds of things?"
"Different, depending on your she-half. For me, it was anger, hunger. I gained a lot of weight.
kept losing my temper over the most idiotic things. She took a drink. And strength. I grew up on a farm. My older brother rolled a tractor and it pinned him, broke his hip, and caught on fire. I picked it up and threw it off him, then dragged him back to the house. More than a mile. I was 12, and my hair had turned this color by the next morning.
Troll, I said quietly. She nodded.
Yeah. I don't know the details about what happened, but yeah. And every time I let those feelings get loose, the more I lost my temper and used my strength, the bigger and stronger I got. And the worse I felt about what I did. She shook her head. Sometimes I think it would be easier to just choose the she half, to stop being human, stop hurting. If it wasn't for the others needing me, it would turn you into a monster. But a happy monster, she finished her beer. I should go and check on Fix. He's sleeping now. Try to call Ace. What are you going to do?
Try to add up some facts, meet some contacts, interview more queens, maybe get a haircut.
Her teeth showed again in a smile, and she rose.
Good luck.
She went back into the noisy apartment and shut the door.
I closed my eyes and tried to think.
Whoever had sent the Tigress, Grum, and the Chlorofiend, and the lone gunman after me was trying to kill me. It was a reasonable assumption, then, that I was on the right track. Generally speaking, the bad guys don't try to bump off an investigator unless they're worried he's actually about to find something. But if that was true, then why had the Tigress taken a shot at me the day before I'd gotten the case? She could have been working for the Red Court and taken a new contract that just happened to be me, but that didn't sound likely. If the ghoul had been on the same contract, it meant that I'd been judged a threat to the killer's plans from day one, if not sooner. The frost on my car's windows had probably been the doing of someone from winter. I mean, a wizard could do the same thing, but as devastating spells go, that one seemed to be kind of limited. The ghoul presumably would work for someone who had paid. The Chlorofiend, though. I hadn't expected it to talk or to be intelligent. The more I thought about the plant monster, the more things didn't add up. It had picked a spot and had its allies herd me to it. And that wasn't the behavior of your average thug, even of the magical variety. It had a sense of personal conflict about it, as if the Chlorofiend had a particular bone to pick with me. And how the hell had Murphy killed it? It was stronger than your average bulldozer, for crying out loud. It had socked me once when I had my full shield going, and it still hurt. It had clipped me a couple of times and nearly broken bones. The Chlorofiend should have flattened Murphy into a puddle of slurry. It had hit her at least a dozen times. Yet it seemed like it only tapped her, as though unable to risk doing more damage. Then a light bulb flashed on somewhere in my musty brain. The Chlorofiend hadn't been a being as such. It had been a construct, a magical vessel for an outside awareness, an awareness both intelligent and commanding, but one who could not, for some reason, kill Murphy when she attacked it. Why? Because, Harry, you idiot, Murphy isn't attached to either of the fairy courts, I told myself, out loud. What's that got to do with it? I asked myself, again, out loud, and people think I'm crazy. Remember, the queens can't kill anyone who isn't attached to the courts through birthright or bargain. She couldn't kill Murphy. Neither could the construct she was guiding.
Damn, I muttered. You're right.
A queen seemed reasonable then, probably from winter, or more realistically, the frosted windshield could have been a decoy. Either way, I couldn't figure who would have had a reason to come after me with something as elaborate as a mind fog and a veritable army of assailants. Which reminded me, the mind fog had come from somewhere. I wasn't sure if the queens could have managed something like that outside of Ferry. If they couldn't, it meant that the killer had a hired gun, someone who could pull off a delicate and dangerous spell like that. I started running down that line of thought, but only a moment later the wind picked up into a stiff, whistling breeze that roared through the air and swept down through the city. I frowned at the sudden shift in the weather and looked around. I didn't find anything obvious, but when I glanced up, I saw the lights going out. A vast cloud bank was racing north, fast enough that I could see it eating the stars. A second wall of clouds was sailing south, toward the first bank. They met in only moments, and as they did, light flashed from cloud to cloud, brighter than daylight, and thunder shook the balcony beneath my feet. Not long after that, a drop of freezing cold water landed on my head, quickly followed by a mounting torrent of chilly rain. The still rising wind whipped into a miserable downpour. I turned and pulled open the door into the apartment with a frown. The alphas were peering out windows, speaking quietly with one another. Across the room, Billy finished messing around with the television, and a rumpled-looking weatherman appeared, the image flickering with interference lines and bursts of snow.
"Guys! Guys!" Billy said. "Hush! Let me listen."
He turned up the volume.
A truly unprecedented event, an enormous Arctic blast that came charging like a freight train through Canada and across Lake Michigan to Chicagoland. And if that wasn't enough, a tropical front, settled quietly in the Gulf of Mexico, has responded in kind, rushing up the Mississippi River in a sudden heat wave. They've met right over Lake Michigan, and we have received several reports of rain and bursts of hail. Thunderstorm warnings have been issued all through the Lake Michigan area, and a tornado watch is in progress for the next hour in Cook County. National Weather Service has issued a flash flood warning and a travel advisory for the eastern half of Illinois. This is some beautiful but very violent weather, ladies and gentlemen, and we urge you to remain in shelter until this storm has had time to... Billy turned the volume down. I looked around the room and found nearly a dozen sets of eyes focused on me, patient and trusting. Bah. Harry, Billy said at last, this isn't a natural storm, is it? I shook my head, got another Coke out of the cooler, and headed tiredly for the door. Side effects, like the toads. What does that mean? I opened the door and said, without looking back, it means we're running out of time. Chapter 23. I took the beetle a ways north of town, keeping to the lake shore. Rain sheeted down and lightning made the clouds dance with shadow and flame. Maybe 10 miles from the center of town, the downpour eased up and the air became noticeably cooler, so that in my jeans and a tee I was shivering. I pulled the car off Sheridan Road, a couple miles north of Northwestern University, out toward Winnetka, set the parking brake and locked it up, and trudged toward the shore of the lake. It was a dark night, but I called no lights to guide me, and I didn't carry a flashlight. It took my eyes a while, but I finally managed to start making out shapes in the darkness, and found my way through the light woods around this part of the lakeshore to a long, naked promontory of rock, thrusting itself a dozen yards into the water. I walked to the end of the stone and waited there for a moment, listening to the thunder rolling over the lake. The wind stirred the water into waves nearly like those of the sea. The air itself was restless, charged with violence, and the light rain that still fell was uncomfortably cold. I closed my eyes, pulling together energy from the elements around me, where water met stone, air met water, stone met air, and drawing as well from my own determination. The power coursed into me, dancing and seething with a quivering life of its own. I focused it with my thoughts, shaped it, and then opened my eyes and lifted my arms, wrists out, so that the old pale round scars on either side of the big blue veins there felt the rain falling on them. I pushed out the power I'd gathered and called into the thunder and rain,
"Godmother! Vente! Lianishi!"
A sudden presence appeared beside me, and a woman's voice said, "Honestly, child, it isn't as though I'm far away. There's no reason to shout." I jerked in surprise and nearly fell into the lake. I turned to my left to face my fairy godmother, who stood calmly upon the surface of the water, bobbing up and down a bit as the waves passed under her feet. Leah stood nearly my own height, but instead of dark contrasts and harsh angles, she was a creature of gliding curves and gentle shades. Hair the color of flame coursed in curls and ringlets to below her hips, and tonight she wore it with a gown of flowing emerald silk, laced through with veins of ochre and aquamarine. A belt made from a twisted braid of silken threads of gold wound around her waist, and a dark-handled knife rested on a slant at her hip through a loop in the belt. She was one of the high she, and her beauty went without saying. The perfection of her form was complemented by features of feminine loveliness, a full mouth, skin like cream, and oblong feline eyes of gold, cat-slitted like most fae. She took in my surprise with a certain reserved mirth, her mouth set with a tiny smile.
"Good evening, Godmother," I said, trying for a proper degree of politeness. "You look lovely as the stars tonight."
She let out a pleased sigh. "Oh, such a flatterer. I'm already enjoying this conversation so much more than the last."
"I'm not dying this time," I said. The smile faded.
"That is a matter of opinion," she responded. "You are in great danger, child."
"Thinking about it, I realize I generally have been whenever you were around."
She clucked reprovingly.
"Nonsense. I've never had anything but your best interests at heart."
I barked out a harsh laugh.
"My interests? That's rich."
Leah arched a brow. "What reason do you have to think otherwise?"
"For starters, because you tricked me out of a big evil slaying magic sword and sold me to Mab."
"Tut," Leah said. "The sword was just business, child. As for selling your debt to Mab, I had no choice in the matter."
"Yeah, right," she arched her brows.
"You should know better, dear godchild. You know I cannot speak what is untrue. During our last encounter, I returned to the Fae with great power and upset vital balances. Those balances had to be redressed, and your debt was a mechanism that the Queen chose to employ." I frowned at her for a minute.
"Returned with great power."
My eyes fell to the knife at her waist.
"That thing the vampires gave you?"
She rested her fingers lightly on the knife's hilt.
"Don't cheapen it. This athame was no creation of theirs. It was less a gift than a trade." "Amarakis and that thing are in the same league? Is that what you're saying?"
Gulp. My fairy godmother was dangerous enough without a big-time artifact of magic.
"What is it?"
"Not what, but whose," Leah corrected me. "In any case, you may be assured that surrendering my claim on you to Mab was in no way an attempt to do you harm. I have never meant you lasting ill." I scowled at her.
"You tried to turn me into one of your hounds and kept me in a kennel, godmother."
"You'd have been perfectly safe there," she pointed out, "and very happy. I only wanted what was best for you, because I care for you, child." My stomach did a neat little rollover, and I swallowed.
"Yeah. It's very you, I guess. In a demented, insane way, I can understand that."
Leah smiled. "I knew you would. To business, then. Why have you called to me this night?" I took a deep breath and braced myself a little.
"Look, I know we haven't gotten along really well lately, or ever, and I don't have a lot to trade with, but I had hoped you'd be willing to work out a bargain with me."
She arched a red-gold brow.
"To what ends?"
"I need to speak to them," I said. "To Mab and to Tanya." Her expression drew distant, pensive.
"You must understand that I cannot protect you from them, should they strike at you. My power has grown, Poppet, but not to those heights."
"I understand. But if I don't get to the bottom of this and find the killer, I'm as good as dead." "So I have heard," my godmother said. She lifted her right hand and extended it to me.
"Then give me your hand."
"I need my hand, godmother, both of them." She let out a peal of laughter.
"No, silly child. Simply put your hand in mine. I will convey you."
I gave her a sidelong look and asked warily,
"At what price?"
"None."
"None? You never do anything without a price." She rolled her eyes and clarified,
"None to you, child."
"Who, then?"
"No one you know or knew," Leah said. An intuition hit me.
"My mother. That's who you're talking about."
Leah left her hand extended. She smiled, but only said,
"Perhaps."
I regarded her hand quietly for a moment and said,
"I'm not sure I can believe that you're really going to protect me."
"But I already have."
I folded my arms.
"When?"
If you will remember that night in the boneyard, I healed a wound to your head that may well have killed you.
You only did it to sucker me into getting you the sword.
Leah's tone became wounded. Not only for that. And if you consider further, I also freed you of a crippling binding and rescued you from a blazing inferno not 24 hours later.
You charged my girlfriend all her memories of me to do it. And you only saved me from the fire so you could put me in the doghouse.
That does not change the fact that I was, after all, protecting you.
I stared at her in frustration for a minute, then scowled. What have you done for me lately?
Leah closed her eyes for a moment, then opened her mouth and spoke. Her voice came out aged and querulous.
What's all that racket? I have already called the police. I have. You fruits, get out of the hall, or they'll lock you away.
I blinked.
Rule's apartment? That was you?
Obviously, child. And at the market earlier this eve? She lifted her hand in the air, made an intricate motion with the long, pale fingers, and opened her mouth again, as if singing a note of music. Instead, the sound of police sirens emerged, somewhat muted and indistinguishable from the real thing. I shook my head.
I don't get it.
She moved her fingers again, and the sirens blended into another silver-sweet laugh, her expression amused, almost fond.
I am sure you do not, Poppet.
She offered her hand again. Come, time is pressing.
She had that part right, at least, and I knew she was telling me the truth. Her words had left her little room for evasion. I've never gotten anything but burned when making deals with the fairies, and if Leah was offering to help me for free, there had to be a catch somewhere. Leah's expression told me that she either knew what I had been thinking or knew me well enough to guess, and she laughed again. Harry, she said, it is not of any consequence to you. Remember that our bargain is still in effect. I am bound to do you no harm for several weeks more.
I'd forgotten about that. Of course, I couldn't fully trust to that either. Even if she had sworn to do me no harm, if I asked her to take me somewhere, she could drop me off in a forest full of unseelie nasties without breaking her word. She'd done something very similar to me last year. Thunder rumbled again, and the light flared even more brightly in the clouds. Tick, 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 the clock was running, and I wasn't going to get anything done standing here waffling. Either I trusted myself to my godmother, or I went back home and waited for something to come along and squash me. Going with Leah wasn't the best way to get what I wanted. It was just the only way. I took a breath and took her hand. Her skin felt like cool silk, untouched by the rain. All right, and after them, I need to see the mothers. Leah gave me an oblique glance and said, Survive the flood before hurling yourself into the fire, child. Close your eyes.
Why?
Annoyance flickered over her eyebrows. Child, stop wasting time with questions. Give me your hand. Close your eyes. I muttered a curse to myself and did it. My godmother spoke something, a string of liquid syllables in a tongue I could not understand, but it made my knees turn rubbery and my fingers suddenly feel weak. A wave of disorientation, dizzying but not unpleasantly so, scrambled my sense of direction. I felt a breeze on my face, a sense of movement, but I couldn't have said whether I was falling or rising or moving forward. The movement stopped, and the whirling sensations passed. Thunder rumbled again, very loudly, and the surface I stood on shook with it. Light played against my closed eyelids. We are here, Leah said, her voice hushed. I opened my eyes. I stood on a solid surface among gray and drifting mist. The mist covered whatever ground I was on, and though I poked at it with my foot, I couldn't tell if it was earth, wood, or concrete. The landscape around me rolled in hills and shallow valleys, all of it covered in ground fog. I frowned up at the skies. They were clear. Stars glittered impossibly bright against the velvet curtain of night, sparkling in dozens of colors, instead of the usual pale silver jewels against the blackness of the void. Thunder rumbled again, and the ground shook beneath the mist. Lightning flashed along with it, and the ground all around us lit with a sudden angry blue fire that slowly faded away. The truth dawned on me slowly. I pushed my foot at the ground again, and then in a circle around me. "We're," I choked, we're on
the clouds, my godmother said, nodding. "Or so it would seem to you. We are no longer in the mortal world."
"The never-never, then? Fairy?"
She shook her head and spoke, her voice still hushed, almost reverent.
"No, this is the world between, the sometimes place, where Chicago and fairy meet, overlap. Chicago over Chicago, if you will. This is the place the queens call forth when the she desire to spill blood."
"They call it forth?" I said in a quiet voice. "They create it?"
"Even so," Leah said, her voice similarly low. "They prepare for war."
I turned slowly, taking it in. I stood on a rise of ground in a broad, shallow valley. I could make out what looked like a mist-shrouded lakeshore not far away. A river ran through the cloudscape.
"Wait a minute," I said. "This is familiar."
"Chicago over Chicago," she had said. I started running in mental images of building streets, lights, cars, people.
"This is Chicago. The land."
"A model of it," Leah agreed, "crafted from clouds and mist." I kept turning and found behind me a stone, gray and ominous and enormous, startlingly solid amid all the drifting white. I took a step back from it and saw the shape of it, a table made of a massive slab of rock, the legs made of more stones as thick as pillars at Stonehenge. Writing writhed across the surface of the stone, runes that looked a little familiar. Norse, maybe? Some of them looked more like Egyptian. They seemed to take something from several different sources, leaving them unreadable. Lightning flashed again through the ground, and a wave of blue-white light flooded over the table, through the runes, lighting them like Las Vegas neon for a moment.
"I've heard of this," I said after a moment. "A long time ago, Ebenezer called it the Stone Table."
"Yes," my godmother whispered.
"Blood is power, child. Blood spilled upon that stone forever becomes a part of who holds it."
"Who holds it?" She nodded, her green eyes luminous. "For half of the year, the table lies within winter, for half within summer."
"It changes hands," I said, understanding. "Midsummer and midwinter."
"Yes, summer holds the table now, but not for much longer." I stepped toward the table and extended my hand. The air around it literally shook, pressing against my fingers, making my skin ripple visibly, as though against a strong wind, but I felt nothing. I touched the surface of the table itself and could feel the power in it, buzzing through the flowing runes like electricity through high-voltage cables. The sensation engulfed my hand with a sudden heat and violence, and I jerked my fingers back. They were numb, and the nails of the two that had touched the table were blackened at the edges. Wisps of smoke rose from them. I shook my fingers and looked at my godmother.
"Let me get this straight. Blood spilled onto the table turns into power for whoever holds it. Summer now, but winter after tomorrow night."
Leah inclined her head, silent.
"I don't understand what makes that so important."
She frowned at the table and began pacing toward it, slowly, clockwise, her eyes never leaving me.
"The table is not merely a repository for energy, child. It is a conduit. Blood spilled on its surface takes more than merely life with it."
"Power," I said. I frowned and folded my arms, watching her. "So if, for instance, a wizard's blood spilled there?" She smiled.
"Great power would come of it. Mortal life, mortal magic, drawn into the hands of whatever queen ruled the table."
I swallowed and took a step back. "Oh." Leah completed her circuit of the table and stopped beside me. She glanced furtively around her, then looked me in the eyes and said, her voice barely audible,
"Child, should you survive this conflict, do not let Mab bring you here. Never."
A chill crawled down my spine.
"Yeah, okay." I shook my head. Godmother, I still don't get what you're trying to tell me. Why is the table so important? She gestured left and right toward a pair of hilltops facing one another across the broad valley. I looked at one, squinting at a sudden blur in my vision. I tried looking at the other, and the same thing happened. I can't see, I said. It's a